The first reading this morning comes from a very fine essay by the poet Carla Brundage, written in 1997. She tells the story of her anger at feeling she had to choose whether to accept her sense of identity as a human being from either her white father or her black mother. She could pass for either, she realized, and that made her even angrier. She concludes her essay about her struggle with these words.
I opened my eyes and began to look at my life. I realized that it was not only hypocritical but impossible to hate my father, a part of myself. At the age of 25, I finally realized that I am mixed, not definable, not in any box, and probably not all that new a phenomenon. Still, people are constantly trying to define me. All people, white and black. For a while, I wanted to wear a sign around my neck that said, "I am black." But slowly, I began to realize I am not just black. I am certainly not white. I am mixed. What does it mean to be a mixed-race woman in America? Recently, my mother told me that we are actually 1/8 Cherokee. This is another part of me that I never even explored, let alone identified with. I am still trying to figure it all out, but I think right now it's about me defining myself, taking that step to say, I am mixed. I am not going to pretend anymore. I am just going to be me.
The second reading is a poem by Lawrence Robb, a poet who is becoming a new favorite of mine. This is from a book written 18 years ago called What We Don't Know About Each Other. The poem itself is called The Other World.
There is another one. It is under this world and inside it. Look at what we're looking at right now. That tree, that hill, who can see it for itself? Even in your own house, sometimes people refuse to understand. You hear it in the way they talk to you. They don't want to understand. They don't believe your happiness. So I used to think I shouldn't say what I knew. Who would listen? Who would stop to talk on such a pleasant morning? But now you've stopped.
When I was a kid in Detroit, my parents had two married friends whom I used to call Uncle and Aunt. although in Detroit we used to say aunt. They had three kids, just like our parents had. Christine was the oldest, about my age, and I still think of her as a kind of cousin, even though we don't share any blood. Her younger brothers, Danny and Donnie, were identical twins. Frankly, I could never tell them apart, ever. It's not that they went out of their way to wear the exact same clothes all the time. They didn't. But they really were completely identical as far as I was concerned. Their eyes, the shape of their faces, their voices, the way they threw their head back and laughed, identical. But Christine could always tell them apart. She never made a mistake. She never seemed to have any struggle. She always called Danny, Danny, and Donnie, Donnie. I asked her once, "Christine, how do you tell them apart? I don't get it. I really, really don't get it." She said, "Well, there's no magic trick. You have to really get to know them really well. There are differences between them that you can only notice once you have really, really gotten to know them. I can't actually point out anything easily to you right now, but I assure you the differences are there. They're not really identical." But to me, those differences were completely invisible. It was a guessing game every single time. Danny? Donnie? I thought of this business of identical twins while thinking about the topic of the sermon this morning, and I even put a photo of some twins on the cover of your orders to underscore this image. Why? Because I've come to notice that when people speak of diversity in our culture, when they speak of differences between people, they almost always speak entirely of visible differences. Is your hair long or short? Curled or limp or wavy or straight? Blonde or black or red? What color are your eyes? Blue is different from brown. Brown is different from green. Skin the color of a mocha shake is different from skin the color of birch wood or cinnamon. Is your body long or low? Easy, isn't it, this diversity business? But strangely enough, I've begun to wonder if the way we talk about diversity isn't kind of a theological issue, one with unintended consequences, in fact. For instance, I often hear folks offer this as a kind of a version of liberal theology. I don't believe in anything that I can't see, can't touch, can't taste, can't hear, can't smell. I didn't see the golden tablets when Joseph Smith claims to have dug them up. So Mormon theology is questionable. I never saw the Virgin at Tepeyac or the woman in the grotto at Lourdes, so I question Roman Catholic proclamations. The angel Jibril did not visit me in a cave, so I am not sure I can trust Muhammad, who claims to have heard an angelic voice. I never saw the empty tomb, so I'm not sure about Christ. Nor do I claim that my intuitions are the Holy Spirit speaking to me, like TV evangelists always say. When I read a text in the Hebrew Scriptures claiming that God orders the murder of women and children, I trust my visceral disgust, but not the text. All very well and good. I understand that theological skepticism. I think the world would be in worse trouble than it already is without that kind of theology being proclaimed. There is so much easy belief in the world, credulity that leads to serious problems. You would be shocked, actually maybe you wouldn't, at how many conservative religious sites on the internet have already proclaimed that Japan deserved this terrible quake because God justly punishes unbelievers with catastrophes. Such statements tarnish the concept of belief, corrupt the meaning of the great word faith, and bring the trust and break the trust needed to build a world into smithereens. But taken as a pattern for life in general, the skeptical approach actually can lead to some trouble as well. For to look at the surface of things, a concrete text, a specific religious claim, a literal story, can lead us to thinking that diversity itself is on the surface, visible, clear, and simple, no work involved. Just open your eyes or unwax your ears. Presto. We're all different. A little bit. But this morning, I think I would like to remind us of the great theologian Paul Tillich's one-word definition of good religion as he understood it. Religion, he said, is the experience of depth, D-E-P-T-H, depth. Or to quote Matthew Fox, another theologian, it's about roots. It's about living a non-superficial and therefore deep life. So another form of liberal theology asks us to live a deeper life that questions what our eyes tell us or our ears hear, and to look for the unseen, the unheard, the unexpected. And this morning I am saying that more of the qualities that make us different from each other, that sign our diversity, are invisible. More of them are invisible than they are visible. Here's what I mean. Try as you might, you cannot see my diabetes. You can't see my blood sugar levels. It affects me. It's a significant part of me. It affects my choices when I eat. Me, I look out there, and I can't see your aches and your pains in your joints, if you happen to have them. Unless you maybe limp around a little bit afterward, and I see that. But mostly people hide their pains. I've learned that after 37 years of the ministry. Every time someone tells me they're going into the hospital for a joint replacement, I'm always genuinely surprised. I've never seen the evidence for it. I can't see dyslexia either. I have a friend who can't read or write. You can look at him. Some of you have actually seen him. He's been here. What you see is a handsome guy with a great smile. You listen to him talk, and you hear a warm voice and a hearty laugh. But he can't fill out a form. Not the simplest form. He can't sign a check. He can't sign his name so anybody can read it, including himself. Believe me, this affects his life. This is a significant part of him. I also can't see any of the misdemeanors he was charged with as a young man. Got into some trouble. Happens sometimes, you know. They're invisible when you look at him. And he hasn't gotten himself into any trouble for the last 7 years. But the computer records that follow him around like his shadow keep him from working at most places he applies to because the computer sees the invisible and makes it visible. And you don't want to have anyone like him in your place. Oh, he's clever. He does find ways to get work. Work that doesn't involve reading or writing much. He is good with numbers, however. In this, he's not much different than Charles Schwab, for whom the Charles Schwab Agency is named. Totally dyslexic, he was. But he's good with investment strategies and numbers. And he's made a name and a fortune for himself, but only by spending most of his time hiding his dyslexia and pretending to be just like everybody else. You also cannot see or hear memories that make people who they are. You can look at me till you are blue in the face, and you will not be able to see the reality inside of me that hits me hard every single day. To wit, that I buried over 30 friends with HIV disease when I was in my 30s and my 40s. I loved every single one of them. So much is invisible, yet entirely real, entirely existent, totally true. I remember a remarkable woman from my former congregation. She was president of the congregation, a very good president, what we call here a board chair. And she was a woman of great charm and power, and the best newsletter editor I ever met. She came to my office one day and said to me, "My son, Martin, he died. He died." And she started to cry. I knew all of her children, and I knew that she didn't have a son named Martin. So I was confused. I held her as she wept, and then I said, quietly in her ear, "Martin? My firstborn," she said. "I delivered him, but he wasn't alive. They took him away. We never mourned. We never had a funeral. We never ever talked about it, my husband and I. No one at the hospital, none of my friends, ever brought it up. It was as if he'd never existed at all in my life. But he did exist. He was real, I tell you. He was real." That must have been 38 years ago, I said, doing some quick math in my head. All of her life, this deep reality, had been completely invisible to everyone around her, and even many days to herself. She was different from women who had not known such grief, but nobody knew that. We ended up doing a funeral service for Martin to make this hidden reality visible by naming it. And as time went on, because we did that, she felt freer to talk about what we had done to others, thus making it visible and plain. And interestingly, she found out that she was part of a rather large circle indeed, the circle of women who grieve. She wasn't alone at all. Her differences from many of her friends were apparent, but not real. Some diversities of experience disappear when they surface. It was their invisibility that made them seem more real than they are. Ask any gay man or lesbian woman what they feel like when they come out and tell people who they are. After years of thinking that they were the only ones on the planet Earth, they all of a sudden realize they are not, and other people may actually want to know who they are. Not for what they have been pretending to be, identical twins with everyone else on Earth. The relief is so great when you discover that you're not alone, that English doesn't have any words to describe that sensation. And please, this idea of invisible diversity doesn't only mean things like illness, or silent memories, or dyslexia, or vegetarianism, which is also invisible. I asked once in my former congregation how many people there that Sunday had Native American roots, as little as 1/16th or even 1/32nd. It was a third of the congregation, a third. I would wager that a surprisingly large percentage of this congregation also has some percentage of Native American heritage in their lifelines. Cherokee, Delaware, Shawnee, especially here in Ohio. Sometimes, but more rarely, Lakota, just like the woman in the reading this morning who discovered she was 1/8 Cherokee. She had never known that. It was invisible even to her. People may think of you as white. People may think of you as black. The two chief abstracted categories in the United States of America. But the real fact is that most people in this room are blends of several cultures, ethnicities, and what we so commonly call races. You never were white like a swab of cotton or black like a stick of licorice. And you are not an identical twin to anyone else on earth, even if you have an identical twin. And that's invisible, too. I don't know how many of you have identical twins or are part of triplets. I know some of you are, only because you've told me. There are still differences between you that those who know you can recognize right off. But most differences are invisible. A guy I know recently told me he was one quarter African-American. I didn't know that. My eyes didn't tell me that. And yet that is as an important part of who he is as his Irish roots. I only knew him as Irish. Carla Brundage, author of the first reading this morning, admits to getting caught up in this business of visible diversity. She was angry, she says, absolutely angry. And she rejected half of her heritage, or the other, at various times, confused because she could pass her words for either white or black. She was painfully aware in our racialized society of the consequences of claiming to be either one or the other. Finally, after years of torment, she writes with lucid honesty, "I'm still trying to figure it all out." She's not alone in that. But I think right now it's about me defining myself, taking that step to say, I'm mixed. I'm not going to pretend anymore. I'm just going to be me. I'm going to be who I am. I've yet to meet someone who doesn't want to be understood and accepted for who they are. I know that's always been an issue for me. Sometimes worrying that I was not being accepted for who I was when I was younger led me to accept rigid categories that I tried to fit myself into, tried to pretend to be, so I could imagine that I was just like everyone else and therefore somehow welcome. But a deeper part of me resented that I had to do that and wanted to be accepted for all of my idiosyncrasies. I even led with my idiosyncrasies sometimes, just to test it out, to push a little bit, to demand. I found Lawrence Robb's poem descriptive of my own early years. "Even in your own house," he writes, "sometimes people refuse to understand you. You hear it in the way they talk to you. They don't want to understand. They don't believe your happiness. So I used to think I shouldn't say what I knew, Who would listen? Who would stop to talk on such a pleasant morning? But now, you've stopped. That last line is incredible. You've stopped. Right. You've stopped right here at a Unitarian Universalist house of worship. Frankly, that's one of the most important reasons I can think of for me to come here, to stop. To stop looking at the surface of things and to go deeper. To find ways to silence the fears that warn us to conform to the categories or to suffer isolation. And to look past the visible diversities in others and in ourselves as well, to find the deeper diversities and to rejoice in them. As the poet says, there is another world. It's under this world. It's inside it. Choose your prepositions. Look at what we're looking at right now. That tree, that hill, who can see it for itself? He's saying, I think, what I learned when my mother used to send me to the refrigerator to fetch something she needed for the pasta she was making. "Mark, please go get me some Romano cheese," she would say. I would go to the refrigerator and look, but I would find no Romano cheese. I would tell her this, and she would say, "It was there this morning. I saw it." I would look again, and I still couldn't find it. She would then come to the fridge, peeved, and she'd find it right there on the shelf in front of my nose. "Here it is, right in front of your nose." Now, why didn't I see it? Because in my head, Romano cheese was this powder-like snowy stuff that we scattered over pasta. What my mother showed me was a beige wedge, a chunk 2 inches thick, cheese before it's grated. I looked right at it, but I didn't see it because I could only see what I expected to see. In the same manner, we see what we are conditioned to see, man or woman, white or black, Asian or Latino, gay or straight, sick or healthy, categories. Or as the poet says, a tree, a hill, we don't actually see what's there. Those are abstractions, falsehoods projected as facts. The tree does not stand alone, after all, singular and isolate. Its roots grow into an ecological system which has no final separation from that tree. The hill is just part of one vast geological upheaval. It's not separate from the plains around it or the sky above it. It's not isolated. Women and men are not isolated either. They overlap in many things. They are unique, but they're also very much alike. There is no way to make it absolute one way or the other. Reality, after all, isn't neat. It flows. My cousin Christine was right. She knew her brothers, Danny and Donnie, more deeply than I did. And thus, she saw them not as identical, but as unique, even if indeed quite similar. To go deeper is the issue, to get past the surface to the invisible. That's another part of liberal theology that needs to partner with the one that relies on the eyes and the ears alone to make judgments about spiritual issues. Sometimes you have to dive deep if you want to really see what's real about somebody else, to really know their name and never get it wrong. There's all kinds of spiritual practices familiar to Unitarian Universalists: meditation, journaling, memoir work, yoga, reading, contemplative prayer, painting, singing, playing. They can all help us to go deeper. But for the coming months, I'm going to try this business of stopping as a spiritual practice. To stop every single time I meet someone and take a moment not to leap ahead of the game. To refuse to make assumptions about who they are by what I see and what I hear. I want to take the time it takes to really get to know someone in their fullness and to guard myself from thinking right off the bat, gosh, I'm a lot like them, or gosh, I'm really different from them. I'm not sure we can know any such thing in a short time. I'm sure those are not the only two choices either. So here's to patience, here's to waiting, here's to questions, here's to me just being me and you just being you. We claim diversity as our strength, our mission statement says. That's only true, I say, when we stop and practice paying as much attention to the invisible diversities as to the visible ones. After all, as our kids said during the little skit this morning, everyone's welcome at this mall. And for goodness sake, please go buy a brownie.